The following message comes to you from the pulpit of Macedonia Primitive Baptist Church in Ackerman, Mississippi. We invite you to visit Macedonia Primitive Baptist Church for worship services every Sunday morning at 10:30 a.m. Macedonia is located at 11 Staten Road on Highway 15, 5 miles north of Ackerman, Mississippi. For more information about Macedonia Primitive Baptist Church, you may visit our website at macedonia-pbc.org.
Let's turn together to the book of Ruth. We considered the first 13 verses of the book of Ruth last week, and we left off where Naomi was preparing to return to Bethlehem, Judah. You remember that her husband Elimelech and her and their two sons, Mahlon and Chilion, went into Moab, the land of the enemy. They left the house of bread during a time of famine, and all Naomi had was misery and heartache and sorrow and death in Moab. And now she hears a report that things are a lot better in Bethlehem, Judah. And unfortunately, she left when times were tough, and now things are better and she wants to ride that wave. So now she's going back, and Orpha and Ruth, her two daughters-in-law, at first want to go back with her, and then she's trying to persuade them not to go with her. And then she essentially says, no, y'all go back to Moab. There's nothing for you in Israel. There's nothing for you here. You are going to be coming from the land of the enemy. You are of a different ethnicity. You are going to be treated very, very poorly. Not to mention that you're going to be a widow. And you have a very slim possibility of being married and having a happy life in Israel. There's nothing for you in Israel. Just go back home. And then in verse 14, and they lifted up their voice and wept again. And Orpha kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clave unto her. And she said, behold, thy sister-in-law is gone back unto her people and unto her gods, return thou after thy sister-in-law. And Ruth said, entreat me not to leave thee, nor to return from following after thee. For whither thou goest, I will go. Whither thou lodgest, I will lodge. Thy people shall be my people, and thy God, my God. Whether thou diest, will I die, and there will I be buried. The Lord do so to me, and more also, if aught but death part thee and me. And when she saw that she was steadfastly minded to go with her, then she left speaking unto her. So they two went they into Bethlehem, and it came to pass when they were come to Bethlehem that all the city was moved about them. And they said, is this Naomi? And she said unto them, call me not Naomi, call me Mara. For the Almighty hath dealt very bitterly with me. I went out full, and the Lord hath brought me home again empty. Why then call ye me Naomi, seeing the Lord hath testified against me, and the Almighty hath afflicted me? So Naomi returned, and Ruth the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law, with her, which returned out of the country of Moab. And they came to Bethlehem in the beginning of the barley harvest. Now Naomi is trying to dissuade, trying to convince these two daughters-in-law that she loves, and they had proven their love for her sons. She saw them caring for her sons as they died, as they passed away. And now they had cared for Naomi during her time of loss, being a widow, having lost her own husband in Elimelech, and now losing two of her sons in the land of Moab. And you can understand the grief that Naomi was dealing with in just a natural sense of losing her husband and losing her two children. And she's already told her daughters-in-law, look, there's nothing for you in Israel. I am bitter and I am miserable, and I care about you, and I don't want you to be as bitter and as miserable as I am, because in her mind, in her skewed mindset, she says that the hand of the Almighty has gone out against her. The hand of God is against me. And it's interesting, when she returns back to Israel, she says, don't call me Naomi, which is pleasant. Call me Mara, which means bitter. But she says, the Lord has dealt bitterly with me. She viewed herself as bitter, and I think she was. I think she assessed herself pretty accurately. She acts pretty bitter. But the sad part is, she blames her bitterness on God. God hath dealt bitterly with me, and therefore I'm bitter. Well, the fact of the matter is, when you make bad decisions, it's oftentimes the case that bad things happen. Okay? Now, praise God that God is a God of mercy. And He's long-suffering, and grace means mercy means not getting what you do deserve. You did something that you ought not done, and yes, this should have been the punishment for it, but God in His mercy sometimes doesn't give us the full brunt of what we've earned. But grace is unmerited favor. That's on top of what you don't deserve. He just gives you blessings upon blessings, right? But instead, Naomi views God in the opposite way. Isn't that sad? That she can't see the fact that I made a bad decision. And yes, time and chance happen to all. Folks pass away. They could have passed away in Israel just as easily as they could have in Moab. It's not because they left that she lost three people. But the fact of the matter is, when you make a decision to leave the people of God and the house of God, and particularly the house of bread, okay, in a time of famine, don't be surprised when bad things happen. Don't be surprised when you go out pleasant and you come back bitter. But the reason that you're bitter is not because the Lord made you bitter. The large quantity of why you're bitter is because you were in a place you shouldn't have been in, doing something you shouldn't be doing, okay? And Orpha, her other daughter-in-law, she cares about Naomi. She loves her. It's very evident, and she loves her. And she lifts up her voice and wept, and they kiss one another, but she decides to go back home, okay? Go back home to Moab, and notice what Naomi says in verse 15, behold thy sister, she's speaking to Ruth, behold thy sister-in-law has gone back unto her God, unto her people, and unto her gods, return thou after thy sister-in-law. Okay, Orpha, she finally gave in, okay, I'm going back. I care about you, Naomi, but you're right, what you're presenting in Israel is not going to be a very, very pleasant life. It's not going to be a very pleasant thing. I'm going to go back. But I want you to notice the language that Naomi uses. She says that this sister-in-law, Orpha, is going back unto her people and unto her gods. That language is very significant with what Ruth is going to say later. But I want you to notice the contrast, okay? The contrast between Orpha is because she did have an affection and love for her mother-in-law. She did. And she was willing to go with her to a certain degree, but she wasn't willing to go all the way to Bethlehem, Judah, okay? But in contrast, I want you to notice the language at the end of verse 14 where it says, but Ruth clave unto her. Ruth clung unto Naomi. And what is the exhibition, okay, of that love that Ruth had toward Naomi? She summarizes this in verses 16 to 17. And this type of commitment is the type of unconditional commitment that is exhibited by agape love. Okay? We have been attempting to consider that on the radio for quite a few weeks now during my time on the program about agape love, charity. What does love look like? Especially in 1 Corinthians 13. And if you haven't listened to those messages, we put them on our website every week, so check them out, because you need to get caught up on those, which will, I believe, add a lot more significance to some of the language that Ruth uses here, okay? But she says to this mother-in-law that she loves, okay? Now, understand, this is a woman that was from a foreign land, had been raised among the Moabites, had worshipped false gods, because that's all that she knew. But then these people from Israel came, and now she was exposed to something different than what she was raised in, okay? And she is willing to forsake her people and her gods because of her love toward Naomi. And she lost her husband, and certainly we're going to look at the marriage relationship, because every marriage vow could be perfectly summarized here in Ruth's commitment toward Naomi, even though it's between a widowed mother-in-law and a widowed daughter-in-law and a widowed mother-in-law. This type of unconditional commitment is the type of commitment, certainly, that a husband makes to a wife and a wife makes to a husband when they make their marriage vows, okay? But in a much broader sense, I want you to understand that this is the type of unconditional commitment that agape love exhibits toward other people that we care about and that we love, okay? And how did Ruth summarize this? She says in verse 16, "Entreat me not to leave thee, nor to return from following after thee. For whither thou goest, I will go. Whither thou lodgest, I will lodge. Thy people shall be my people. Thy God shall be my God. Whither thou diest, will I die, and there will I be buried. And the Lord do so to me, and more also, if aught but death part thee and me." What is it that is commonly said in a marriage covenant and a marriage vow? It is till death do us part, for better or for worse, and richer or in poor, sickness or in health. And that, how is that all summarized? Till death do us part. She says, first of all, entreat me not to leave you. I love you, okay? I care about you. And you've told me that the going's going to be tough when we get over to Israel. But, you know, I love you. And if you tell me to go back home, I love you enough, I might follow you. You know, I might do what you tell me to do if you really love me that much. But please don't tell me to leave. Entreat me not to leave thee or return from following after thee. But notice this commitment. For where thou goest, I will go. Anywhere you go, I am going to be right there by your side. Okay, and this language is so significant. In verse 14, it says that Ruth clave unto her. Clave unto her. And this is the exact same Hebrew word that's used in Genesis chapter 2 with the original commitment and the original commandment of the type of connection that a man and a wife should have in the marriage covenant and the marriage relationship. And this word clave, which here in Genesis chapter 2 is translated as cleave instead of clave, okay? It literally means to affix oneself unto something, okay? The New Testament Greek that's used in Mark chapter 10 and Ephesians chapter 5 that we hope to look at in just a minute, that New Testament Greek literally means to glue upon, to be permanently affixed to something. Okay? I want you to understand the significance of that word. To glue upon, to be stuck together like Gorilla Glue. Like super glue. Have you ever tried to super glue something together and then pull it apart? Unfortunately, I've never been very efficient when I've used super glue. Half of it ends up on my hand, which is very annoying, by the way. It's very difficult to get super glue off your hand. I'm most of the time very inefficient when I am super gluing something. But have you ever tried to put something together, and once you super glue it, it's adhered to it, it's cleaved to it, and then the only way that you can pull that apart, you can never put it back. If you had two things that were separate by themselves, but you glue them together with that permanent adhesive, okay? If you tear apart that union, you're going to destroy both parts. That part, both of those parts can never go back to how they were before. Why? Because they've been glued together. And I want you to notice from Ruth's language, it would have been very reasonable, okay, for her to do what Orpha did. I love you, but I'm just going to go back to the way things were. I'm going to stay in my comfort zone. I'm going to hang out with my people. I'm going to hang out with the gods that I grew up worshiping. But instead, she says that I am willing to forsake all of that and glue myself to you. And where you go, I'm going to go. Where you lodge, I'm going to lodge. Why? Because I am gluing myself to you. Now, this should underscore the character of Ruth so much, because she ain't making this commitment to Boaz, who is a godly man and very attentive to Ruth. This is a self-described bitter old woman. But you know what? Ruth loved this bitter old woman. And she said that I'm going to stick myself to you like glue. But I want you to notice that it is voluntary. Okay? The marriage covenant is voluntary. And love is voluntary. The commitment, the unconditional commitment of love is voluntary. But because of the love that she had, she was willing to make herself obligated to this other person. And that's what happens in a marriage covenant especially, right? Genesis chapter 2. We see in Genesis chapter 1 how God creates all of the land and all of the creatures during the first 5 days. And then it's summarized, the sixth day is summarized in verse 27 of chapter 1. So God created man in his own image, and in the image of God created him. Male and female created he them. But then in the second chapter, you kind of have a zoomed in, more in-depth narrative to the sixth day. Okay? Because on the sixth day, he created male and female both. Right? That's what we see in verse 27. But now, in Genesis chapter 2, we see the full detail of the creation of man, but also the creation of the woman. So all of this happened, okay? It was a very busy day. Adam had a very busy day. He was created in the morning, and the evening and the morning were the first day. And God said, hey, you're going to keep this garden, you're going to dress it, you're going to keep it. He gave him a commandment in verse 16 of Genesis chapter 2. Of every tree of the garden thou mayest freely eat, but of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, thou shalt not eat, and the day thou eatest thereof, thou shalt surely die. He gave him that commandment on day 6, okay? And then the Lord said, it is not good that man should be alone. I will make a helpmeet for him. And out of the ground the Lord formed every beast of the field and every fowl of the air, and brought them unto Adam to see what he would call them. And whatsoever Adam called every living thing, that was the name thereof. And Adam gave names to all the cattle, and to the fowl of the air, and to the every beast of the field. And for Adam, there was not found a helpmeet for him. So, he was created. Oh, I'm alive, right? And now, he spends the rest of his day, or most of his day, probably would take a while, to naming all the animals, right? And the Lord said, I want you to notice how the Lord initiates this. The Lord created man in his own image. And this man, this wasn't a fallen man yet, okay? This was a man that was still an upright and a good man, but he still looked at man by himself and said, man, that poor fella. He ain't gonna make it by himself. That boy needs some help. And that's not, and boy, if you think us fallen men after the fall need some help, God looked at man before the fall and said, man, he ain't gonna make it by himself. It's not good that man should be alone. Isn't it interesting that, you know, the first five days, God said he looked at everything he did and it was good. And then by the end of the sixth day, he said everything was good and very good. But I want you to notice, during the middle of that sixth day, God said something was not good. Okay? By the end of the day, it was very good. Why? Because God created a woman. But in the middle of that sixth day, God said, there's something that's not good, and this man does not need to be alone. I need to make a helper that is suitable for him. That's what help meet means. A helper that is suitable, that will fill all of his shortcomings with her own strengths. Okay? That's the beauty of marriage. That's the beauty of male and female. Because we're different. But those differences are compatible, okay? To where the union between a man and a woman, the end result, the one flesh end result of that union is better than those two people would be apart, okay? That's how we need to make sure that we understand marriage. The one flesh union is greater than the sum of its parts. Think about a body, and you got a hand and a foot. Well, yeah, those hands and foots are all right by themselves, I guess. But they're pretty much irrelevant unless they're in the context of the entire body. Okay? The sum of the parts is greater than the individual parts. Right? And see, that is the beauty of an appropriate helpmeet for us sorry fellas. Is that the sum of the parts is greater than those two parts individually. Okay? And I want you to notice how God takes the initiative. Why does God take the initiative? Because it's not good that man should be alone. And the Lord caused a deep sleep in verse 21 to fall upon Adam. And he slept and took one of his ribs and closed up the flesh instead thereof. And the rib which the Lord God had taken from him, he made a woman and brought her unto the man. He puts a sleep upon Adam. He takes one of his ribs. You see, Adam goes on to say in verse 23, this is now bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. He's not just being poetic. This was literally bone of his bone and flesh of his flesh. And why is it, as he says in verse 24, therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother and shall cleave. Same word, cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh. Why is that the case? Because they came from one flesh. The woman literally came from the same flesh as Adam, okay? Now, I love the imagery in verse 22 that he takes a rib out of Adam, and he makes the woman, and he, God, brought her unto the man. In our customary wedding ceremony, it's the father of the bride that walks her down the aisle. And that's essentially what God did with the woman in bringing her to Adam. He created her. He is her father in creation. And what did he do? He walked her down the aisle. He brought her down to Adam. And Adam said, this is now bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh, and she shall be called woman because she was taken out of man. And then in verse 24, therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh. So you have two individual people, but then in a voluntary commitment to obligate themselves to one another, but more importantly, and Ruth exhibits this as well, they obligate themselves unto God for their commitment to this person, to death do them part. Okay? Because what did Ruth say in the final phrase of her speech there in Ruth chapter 1? She said, "Where you go, I'm going to go. Where you die, I will die, and I'm going to be buried. And the Lord do so to me also, if anything but death parts us." In other words, and I want you to understand the significance of a widow saying that, okay? She had seen her husband die. And she said, "Lord, you kill me if I forsake my covenant to love Naomi. You kill me if I break this covenant." Why? Because she was willing to voluntarily obligate herself to that other person, but obligate herself for God to be her judge if she broke that covenant. Okay? "Therefore shall a man leave his father and his mother." There is a relationship up until marriage that takes a significant priority in your life. Now, that relationship is not severed totally, okay? Because children have a responsibility to care for their parents, especially during the latter years. You have a biblical responsibility to do that. But there is a relationship that takes priority when you voluntarily choose to commit yourself to another person and to commit yourself unto God to love this person to death do you part, okay? You leave this prior relationship that you have with your father and your mother. That relationship now is not your primary relationship, because you are a one flesh union with another person. "And they shall cleave," he shall cleave unto his wife. And literally that means to be stuck like glue. That nothing will separate that. Let's go to Mark chapter 10. Jesus reiterates this teaching in the New Testament in multiple places, and Mark chapter 10 is about the most succinct dealing with that. The Pharisees had placed a lot of outs and a lot of conditions upon divorce, and they were essentially looking for an excuse to be able to divorce their wives that they weren't happy with anymore. Verse 2, "And the Pharisees came to him and asked him, 'Is it lawful for a man to put away his wife, tempting him?' And Jesus answered and said, 'What did Moses command you?'" In other words, what does the Bible say? What does the law say? "Moses suffered to write a bill of divorcement and to put her away." Even they acknowledge that Moses suffered it. Okay? And then Jesus clarifies, the reason why he suffered it and the reason why God suffered it is not because that was God's intended purpose. Why did he suffer men in the Levitical law to put away them under the most extreme circumstances, and they were not doing it under the most extreme circumstances? They were doing it for trivial circumstances, okay? And he says, why did Moses suffer that? And Jesus clarifies it very succinctly, right? "For the hardness of your heart, he wrote you this precept." It's because you're stubborn. And I understand man is frail, a man's but dust, and he's going to make mistakes. And you know what? I gave you this provision, but you have abused that provision. Man's pretty good at that, right? God gives us an inch and we take a foot. We mischaracterize some of the liberty that Christ has given us. But I want you to notice how he clarifies what we just saw in Genesis chapter 2. "For from the beginning of creation," as a side note, by the way, Jesus says it was from the beginning of creation that God created male and female. And God created the entire world and everything we see in six 24-hour days, the evening and the morning were the first day, and the second day and the third day, and God rested on the seventh day. It was not millions of years, but between the first day and the sixth day. Why? Because Jesus says, from the beginning of creation, it's when God created male and female. Not a billion-year time gap, okay? It was at the beginning. It was on the sixth day, right after he started creation, okay? For from the beginning of the creation, God made them male and female. For this cause shall a man leave his father and mother and shall cleave, to be stuck to, like glue, to be permanently adhered to, and they twain shall be one flesh. They are no more twain, but one flesh. Again, the sum of the parts. And see, don't you love God's math? Jesus was 100% God and 100% man. God is three persons in one, but yet he's one in three. One plus one plus one equals one. Okay? And he says, oh, what do you think is greater? We think two people, that's 200%. 200% is greater. What does God say is greater? One flesh. He says, essentially, the 100% union of a man and his wife in a God-ordained marriage, that 100% is greater than your 200% separately. Does that make sense? Why? Because God's way is always better. Okay? His 100% is a whole lot better than your individual 200%. And I want you to notice in verse 9, what therefore God hath joined together, let not man put asunder. I want you to understand that it's not just in a marriage covenant that you have some feelings down in your heart, and I want to be able to live with this person, so therefore, because of these feelings, I'm going to go through this ceremony. I want you to understand, you are covenanting before God. And we may not use this language in American marriages, but I want you to understand, God holds you to the same standard of the commitment that Ruth made to Naomi. If anything but death severs this union, the Lord do so to me. Why? Because God has joined that together. What God has joined together, let not man put asunder. How do you become one flesh? It's not by some justice of peace signing a piece of paper. You become one flesh just because God has joined you together. And I want you to understand, if you've made that covenant before Jehovah God, and you break that covenant, you will face the repercussions of the breaking of that covenant. Okay? What God has joined together, let not man put asunder. Ephesians chapter 5. I don't have time to deal with all of this, of the teaching of husbands and wives, so we're going to skip down to the latter portion. Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 29. For no man ever hated his own flesh, but nourisheth and cherisheth it, even as the Lord the church. For we are members of his body, and of his flesh, and of his bones. For this cause shall a man leave his father and mother, and shall be joined unto his wife, and they two shall be one flesh. This is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church. Nevertheless, let every man of you in particular so love his wife, even as himself, and the wife see that she reverence her husband. What is the standard for a husband's love toward his wife? It's Christ's love of the church. You understand that the church of Christ is the bride of Christ. And he came into this world to lay down his life for his bride. He proved the love that he covenanted and he attested to before the foundation of the world. He proved it by actions. Love's about action, guys. Okay? It doesn't matter what you say if actions don't back it up. And God proved his love for his elect by coming in this world and laying down his life for his bride. And you cannot say that you love someone if your actions say the exact opposite. Okay? What is the standard for love? God is love. Okay? And the standard for a husband loving their wife is Christ loving the church. And it's not just about you saying, oh, if a robber comes into my house, I'll just step in front of the bullet. It's about you getting up every single day and sacrificing yourself for the benefit of your wife and your family. It's not about you stepping in front of a bullet. It's about you living a life of sacrifice. Why? Because Christ loved the church. Because you are one flesh. And you have made a covenant before God to love that person to death do you part. And I'll tell you, that's the only thing that should part you. Barring the most extreme circumstances. Praise be to God, we've got a husband that lives forever. Isn't that? Yes, marriage is a special relationship here in time, but the fact of the matter is, we're not going to be married in heaven. Jesus made that clear, okay? It's a special blessing here in time, but there is a relationship that is going to take priority in heaven. And it's not your relationship with your husband and wife here on earth. It's your relationship with your heavenly husband. Okay? We are members of His body. I mean, we are... Isn't it amazing that we are... This whole teaching about marriage, okay? You have to see Christ's relationship with His bride properly for you to be the kind of husband and wife that you need to be, okay? And in the specific roles. And that is why it's so important for us to see the sacrifice that Christ makes for His bride when then He tells you to leave father and mother. What did God do? What did Jesus do to come into this world to redeem His bride? He left His father. He left the comforts of heaven because of no other reason than He made a voluntary commitment that He bound to be held accountable to before His father. Okay? But He fulfilled that covenant because we... And because of that, we're separated right now, the husband and the wife, we're separated. He's in heaven, we're on the earth. But we will be one in perfect unity with God for all of eternity. This is a great mystery, but I speak concerning Christ and the church. There's a lot that's mysterious about that. But it makes me really happy. It makes my soul very happy when I read scriptures that says, I will be known even as I am known. There is no knowledge and intimacy that's more close here on this earth than a husband and a wife. Okay? And by the way, if people want to ask us what we believe about salvation and what we believe about God's love, the greatest testimony in our churches for the unconditional love of Christ as a husband to the church and His bride should be the unconditional love that we exhibit in a marriage relationship. Your marriage should preach the gospel to other people. Your marriage should exhibit what unconditional love looks like to other people, to where now my actions can validate the fact that I say that I believe that Christ, as our husband, died for us unconditionally. And because of the way that we interact and we sacrifice for one another, those actions exhibit the gospel that we profess. Okay? Now, Ruth said, "Wherever you go, I'm going to go. Wherever you lodge, I will lodge." I want you to notice this language. "Thy people shall be my people." She was a Moabite, and she was going to be a foreigner in the land that her Moabite folks have just been oppressing the Israelites for 18 years. How do you think a Moabite is going to be treated when they show up in Israel? Not good. Not good at all. And aside from that, the fact of the matter is she's most likely going to have a different complexion. She's going to be of a different ethnicity. It's not just that, hey, we don't like you because you have been oppressing us for 18 years. And we know the way that the Jews viewed non-Jews, right? She was not going to be treated well. But what did she say about going into this culture where she knew that she would be most likely be ostracized? What'd she say? "Those are your folks, and because of my love, they're going to be my folks. Thy people shall be my people, and thy God shall be my God. Your Elohim will be my Elohim. I am forsaking." This tells us a lot about Ruth. "I am forsaking the worship of these false gods in Moab because I believe in Jehovah God." Okay? She did. Now, what did Orpha do? She went back to her people and her gods. But what did Ruth say? "Your folks, your people, they're going to be my people. Your God is going to be my God." And the only reason she can say that is because God was already her God. Right? "Where thou diest will I die, and there will I be buried. The Lord do so to me." I want you to notice, she calls down the authority of Jehovah God to hold her accountable to this covenant she's making to Naomi. Yes, that's significant, but it's really significant for a Moabite to be doing that, okay? This is a person who grew up worshiping false gods, and she's calling down the authority of Jehovah God to say, "You kill me if I break my covenant." When she saw that she was steadfastly minded to go with her, then she left speaking unto her. All right, it seems like you've got your mind made up, Ruth. Let's go on back. Why? Because Ruth clave to her. Now, the most appropriate picture of this is certainly marriage. But I want you to understand, there is a commitment and a covenant that we have a responsibility to love other people unconditionally. But I want to especially highlight the unconditional commitment that we have a responsibility to in the church. Because when you join the church, you're not just saying that I'm going to be added to a sheet of paper on the rolls of Macedonia Church. You are making a public profession for other people, before other people, and before God. You are making a covenant to be faithful to the Lord and to the church, for better or for worse, for richer or poorer, till death do you part. Okay? Now, there are way too many children of God that when famine comes in the kingdom, they check out. Okay? And then when things get good, oh, I'm a member. I'm going to show back up on the rolls. Things are rolling. The grain's flowing out of the bins now. Let me show back up. I want to tell you, commitment, we don't emphasize this in the church in the manner that we really ought to. I don't believe that ours is officially written down. Many churches have an official church covenant, okay? And essentially, every person that joins the church, that person would, okay, I believe these articles of faith, but I am attesting to this church covenant. And when you submit to believer's baptism, you are submitting that I'm not going to leave the house of bread.
whether it's a time of famine or whether it's a time of plenty, where things are great or whether things are bad. Why? Why? Because thy God will be my God. He's God. And I am choosing to voluntarily obligate myself to the bride of Christ. And I am calling down the authority of God to hold me accountable if I am not faithful to my covenant to the bride of Christ and the church. I want you to understand, we don't have the authority or the option to check out when times get tough. You don't. Why? Because Jesus came in this world and died for your sins, okay? During times of famine, during times of plenty, this is the same commitment and covenant that we make when we obligate ourselves to the bride of Christ till death do us part. And that's the only way that any church member should ever be removed from the roles. When they are promoted to the roles of the ultimate bride of Christ in heaven. We got to take them off our roles, but they're getting added to their final destination of the bride of Christ. So now they arrive back in Bethlehem, right? The two went and came to Bethlehem, and it came to pass when they were come to Bethlehem that all the city was moved about them, and they said, "Is this Naomi?" Now understand, Naomi had been gone for 10 years. Not only had she aged 10 years, but she had a lot of sorrow in those 10 years. And I'll tell you, difficult times make you age fast. Let's just be honest. She showed up after being gone for 10 years, and it's almost like the whole city is kind of stirred up about it. And they said, "Man, is that Naomi? That doesn't even look like her." Oh, but now she showed up with a Moabite woman here. What's going on here? And then she says, "Call me not Naomi," which means pleasant, "but call me Mara." Call me bitter, "for the Almighty hath dealt very, very bitterly with me." See, she's blaming her bitterness on the Lord. Now, it's very unfortunate that she lost her husband and her sons. I'll tell you, in this world, you shall have tribulation. Jesus told us that. He didn't paint a rosy picture and give us a false pretense of the challenges we're going to have here in this world. In this world, you shall have tribulation, but be of good cheer. Why? Because I've overcome the world. Because I came into the world and died for the bride. And you're going to be with me for all of eternity. Praise the Lord. But in the midst of tribulation, she blames her bitterness on God. There are so many children of God that, and it's really because they don't have the proper stabilizing truth of many of the things that the Bible teaches. And if they did, they would be able to deal with some of these challenges in life better. They wouldn't turn on the Lord like that. But instead, Naomi is blaming the Lord for her bitterness. And I want you to notice the way, boy, this sure is the truth, the way that we misremember history. She says, "I went out full, and the Lord hath brought me again home empty." Again, the Lord. It's the Lord's fault that I came back home empty. "Then why call ye me Naomi, seeing the Lord hath testified against me, and the Almighty hath afflicted me?" Hey, Naomi, you didn't go out full. You left during a time of famine. And guess what? You didn't come back home empty. You came back home when times were plenty. And not only that, you added something that was a whole lot better than what you left with, a daughter-in-law that was willing to go to the death for you. That was a pretty good addition. That was a pretty good blessing and benefit. But she says, "Oh man, I went out full. Everything was great when I left." No, it wasn't. It was a time of famine. And when I came back, "Oh, everything's horrible." No, it's not. Think about the Israelites when they got a little bit thirsty and a little bit hungry in the wilderness. "Oh, man, we really should go back to Egypt. It was great back there when we were in bondage and we had all this onions." You might like onions. I don't like onions. If you're excited about going back home and eating onions, Lord bless you. And they're looking, they're in the wilderness and saying, oh man, I just wish we had them nasty onions. The Lord's about to give you manna from heaven. Then he gives you quail. He gives you water out of a rock. But they get a little bit thirsty, a little bit hungry. Oh man, I really wish we were back in bondage. We have quite a tendency to over glamorize the difficult times, don't we? And under depreciate the blessings of God. She's acting like she left with everything and she came back with nothing. Well, you know what? Maybe you should have stayed in the house of bread to start with. And maybe you wouldn't be so bitter right now. I tell you, if you leave, if you choose to go the Naomi Elimelech route, the prodigal son route, you're always going to leave pleasant and come back bitter. That's the only thing this world is going to offer you, is bitterness. But I want you to notice in the midst of this backdrop of her, Naomi's very dramatic, by the way, if you haven't noticed this. Very dramatic. But in the midst of her return and her blaming the Lord, isn't it interesting that the Lord used this bitter old woman as the conduit to get Ruth to where she needed to be at in his providence, that she ended up being one of the grandmothers of David? That's what we're going to see in the fourth chapter. But God used a bitter old woman to get Ruth to where she needed to be at. And you know what? I would dare say, outside of the circumstances that happened, Ruth would have never, ever been grafted into the culture and the genealogy in Bethlehem, Judah. Never. But God didn't cause it. But God, in his providence, overrules the mistakes and the bad decisions and the bad attitudes of his children. He took a woman with a bad attitude to get one of his children to where she needed to get to. And I want you to notice this very unassuming phrase at the end of this chapter. Naomi returned, and Ruth the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law, with her, which returned out of the country of Moab, and they came to Bethlehem in the beginning of the barley harvest. And that sets the tone for the entire rest of the book. Why? Because she's going to go and she's going to labor in the beginning of the barley harvest in the field of a man called Boaz, who, oh, by the way, just happens to be her kinsman, who, oh, by the way, just happens to be willing to redeem her. And, oh, by the way, this Ruth the Moabitess ends up having a son who is one of the fathers that lead into the genealogy of David. God did not cause the difficulties that came to Naomi. He certainly did not cause Elimelech and Naomi to leave the house of bread. But I want you to notice the amazing testimony of the overruling providence of God in the midst of his people just messing it up left and right. And God did not write out before the foundation of the world that they were going to show up at the beginning of the barley harvest. But God, in his overruling providence, they've been gone for 10 years. Okay, I want you to think about the timeline here. I cannot overemphasize this. They've been gone for 10 years, okay? And they show up at the exact beginning of the barley harvest. I want you to understand that God's timing is always perfect. Always. Ecclesiastes chapter 3 and verse 11. He hath made everything beautiful in his time. Not your time, in his time. And things looked very, very bleak during 10 years in Moab, and all they had was misery. But guess what? God used a bitter old woman, and for some reason, a lady, a godly woman who loved that bitter old woman, and they came back into Bethlehem, and oh, by the way, it just so happened, not by chance, but by the providence of God, that they showed up at the exact beginning of the barley harvest. I'm so thankful that God is in the business of bringing beauty for ashes. He's in the business of overruling our mistakes. He's in the business of God is a God of mercy and grace. And we mess things up and God fixes them. That's the story of salvation, by the way. That's the story, and that story just is on repeat in our lives. It's the story of eternity, and it's the story of time in our lives here. We mess up, and God, in His mercy and grace, blesses us in spite of ourselves. And oftentimes, it might be the beginning of the barley harvest in our life, too. It might be the beginning of, yeah, Moab's not fun. Yeah, there's nothing but misery in Moab. That's what we talked about last week. But I want you to understand, when you get to where you're supposed to be at, remember, where do they come back to? The house of bread. The place it should have been the whole time. When they get back to where they ought to be, God got them there at the exact right time. And they are going to receive blessings because they're in the right place, serving God in the right field.
We thank you for listening to today's message and invite you to visit Macedonia Primitive Baptist Church for worship services every Sunday morning at 10:30 a.m. Macedonia is located at 11 Staten Road on Highway 15, 5 miles north of Ackerman, Mississippi. For further information about Macedonia Primitive Baptist Church, you may visit our website at macedonia-pbc.org.